And welcome once again to the MANCAD, British Academy of Audiology podcasts. As you know, MANCAD stands for the Manchester Centre for Audiology and Deafness, and we're located at the University of Manchester in the UK. I'm Gabby Saunders, I'm a Senior Research Fellow, and I moderate our podcasts. And we address topics that are pertinent to audiology and we hope have relevance to audiologists, researchers, and really anybody interested in hearing loss. We have a monthly podcast, and they last about 20 minutes. And we always post a transcript of the podcast. On to today, Hannah Guest from MANCAD is going to be discussing, should we believe our ears? Questionable research practices in hearing science. Hannah's a research associate here at MANCAD. And Hannah, I'm going to pass it over to you now just to tell me a little bit about yourself.
Hi, Gabby. Thanks for having me. I am, as you say, a research associate, finished my PhD in 2018, so I'm still at the stage of figuring out my place in auditory research. But in general, my work has tended to look at ways of measuring and understanding hearing differences beyond the audiogram. So ways that the cochlea and auditory brain might be affected by noise exposure or aging without it showing up in audiometric thresholds, and also how hearing might differ in neurodivergent populations.
Thank you. Thank you, Hannah. Today, we're going to be talking about how scientists and readers of science should take care when they're interpreting data and give some warnings about how to avoid falling into the trap of overinterpreting data, i.e. mistakenly believing that findings are saying more than they really are. Hannah, have I summarized that properly?
Yeah, I'd say that's fairly spot on. The headline really is that science has gone a bit wrong somewhere along the line, and we as a field need to think about data more rigorously, or else we risk believing in scientific phenomena that are not real. And this obviously could have pretty dire consequences in terms of wasted research money and people wasting large portions of their careers looking for effects that just aren't real, and even potentially consequences for patients and for the public.
Yeah, that's a really, really important topic. So what led you to start thinking about this in the first place?
I think two things had to happen, really. One was reading about really solid evidence of widespread problems in science, especially in fields that are kind of similar to our own. And the other was seeing those problems happening closer to home. By the time I was midway through my PhD, there were already a really decent number of really important papers on widespread problems in the biomedical and the psychological sciences. And in particular, there was this issue of important results not being replicable. So what that means is that a research team carries out a study and it produces evidence of some relation between things. So maybe a relation between some food supplement and bone health, say. And then that study is repeated with the same methods, but a different sample, but it produces a different result the second time around. And the crux of the issue is that in many cases, perhaps most cases, the reason a finding can't be replicated is that it wasn't real in the first place. So although this state of affairs is often referred to as the replication crisis, really it's a falseness crisis, because the purpose of science ultimately is not to replicate findings, but to make claims that are true. But at the time that I was reading about this stuff, it kind of felt like a fairly far away problem, because the people I worked with seemed to be really careful about avoiding this stuff. And it's only really been as time has gone on and I've seen examples in the real world and gotten better at spotting examples in the real world that I've realized this is something we all need to consider. And not just junior researchers like me engaged in the day-to-day business of research, but also anyone who is supervising or managing or advising researchers and readers of research and peer reviewers and journal editors and funders and hiring committees. And basically anyone involved in the research ecosystem has a part to play, in my opinion.
Yeah. Well, I look forward to hearing what you're going to say as we go along here. But first, you sort of mentioned saying that you've seen these problems, as you put it, closer to home. So what have you seen in the world of hearing science that makes you concerned for our field?
Well, there's no smoking gun, but pretty much every corner of the biological and social sciences is affected by this stuff. So it's highly unlikely that we're immune. And I would say that just from being an active member of our field, it's fairly clear to me that we're not immune. Our research literature is packed full of studies with small sample sizes and low power, which should mean that we see a lot of negative results. And yet most papers report positive results. And when you look at the p-values that are being reported, they show this kind of unnatural pattern where you've got loads of p-values at 0.03 and 0.04 and almost none at 0.05 and 0.06. And, you know, if we're to put it bluntly, if researchers weren't being tempted to nudge results in the right direction, then this disparity wouldn't exist. But I can't remember the last time I saw a p-value of 0.05, at least not as the main result reported in a paper. So another thing I've seen that kind of raises questions is use in hearing science of the questionable research practices that we'll be discussing in a minute. I think what I would admit is that if you're a skeptic of the idea that there's any problem in our field, then as I said, none of this is a smoking gun. And I think probably what we need is some kind of large scale analysis of the literature to check how we're doing in hearing science. So perhaps something like a statistical analysis based on text mining of a large number of papers. And I think that's probably what it will take to get a critical mass of people in our field to take this seriously and make sure that we all do better work in future.
That's an interesting approach. I mean, I hopefully by the end of your podcast here, we'll all go away and rethink what we do on a daily basis anyway.
That's the hope.
But anyway, so what do you think is causing these false positive, which I'm thinking what you're saying are the false positive results, right?
Yes, absolutely. False positive results. So claiming to find a relation between two variables when actually no relation exists. So in terms of what we think is causing them, I think the answer to that has a few different parts. One part is what's driving this process. So what are the incentives and structures that are pushing researchers to do this stuff? And then there's the question of how the false results are generated. So what are the mechanisms? I think the first question is probably the most interesting and arguably the most important. I think what it comes down to is that throughout our careers, we researchers are rewarded for having positive findings. Academia, as you know, is really competitive, and there's far more people with PhDs out there than there are permanent academic positions. So researchers like me need to stand out to survive. You need to publish a lot and you need to appear groundbreaking. And most journals just really like publishing positive results, especially novel positive results. So if you were to take a cynical careerist point of view, then you'd have to conclude that it is more important to generate novel positive findings than it is to do good, rigorous science. Currently, if you want to make it as a researcher, dodgy methods get results.
Yeah, I could see that. So dodgy methods, do you want to talk a bit more about that?
More formally, these are what we'd call questionable research practices. A really common one that people may have heard of is p-hacking, which essentially is just altering your analysis methods, maybe many times over until you get the positive result that you're looking for. Similar to that is harking, which stands for hypothesizing after results are known, which is testing for relations between lots of different variables in a study. And then one test comes up positive, acting as if that's what you had hypothesized in the first place. There's also opportunistic stopping, which is waiting until you've got just enough participants in a study to show a positive result, possibly by chance, and then you stop recruiting in case adding any extra participants would have made the effect disappear. There's also creative outlier removal, which is where you decide that some data points must be outliers because you've noticed that removing them makes your analysis go in the direction you want. And on the other hand, there's deciding that potential outliers aren't outliers because you've noticed that leaving them in your analysis makes it go in the right direction. Then there is failing to correct for multiple comparisons, which is when you run a lot of statistical tests and you fail to adjust the required p-values, which is something you need to do when there's more than one statistical test. Or maybe you correct for some multiple comparisons so that you can say that you've done it, but actually there are a bunch of other hidden comparisons that you haven't corrected for. There are undoubtedly other QRPs that I've forgotten, but what most of them have in common is that they rely on making decisions about the design of your study when the data are already in. So this is what we call post hoc decision making. And many of these QRPs are also made possible or made worse by small sample sizes. And I think that those two points are going to be important to bear in mind when we're thinking about what we can do to potentially fix what's broken in hearing science.
Yes, golly, there's so much there. I've got a whole bunch of questions, but I'm gonna first ask you. So do you think scientists are deliberately producing false positives, or is it some kind of accidental? What's going on?
I think it's probably some interesting combination of the two. I think a lot of it is unconscious or not fully conscious, because the seductive thing about QRPs is that they can get you positive results without you necessarily feeling like you're doing anything wrong. So if I can give you an example, with opportunistic stopping, so you're running a study and you're not absolutely concrete about how many participants you'll be recruiting. And as you're going along, you're running interim analyses, and each new participant changes the results of your analyses slightly. So you get to the stage where you see the effect that you want, and you pretty quickly stop collecting data. And maybe if you'd carried on, the effect would have disappeared. Maybe it would have reversed. Maybe it's just this positive result is actually just a result of random statistical variation. But what you can tell yourself is, no, this was the natural point to draw this study to a close. You know, I always knew I needed to stop and get this written up before the summer, and 25 is a pretty good number of participants, and probably that is what I was aiming for. Yeah, you know, I think I did say at a meeting that I was aiming for 25. And then something similar happens when it comes to p-hacking. So p-hacking comes in a lot of different flavors, but basically it means that you tweak your analysis until it gives a positive result, and then you report that version of the analysis and ignore all the rest that you did beforehand. And p-hacking can be especially easy and effective in auditory neuroscience because there are so many different ways to process and analyze brain data, and you can tweak all of them at the same time until you find the magic combination that gets you the result that you want. But again, as a researcher, I think you're probably not clear that this is what you're doing. So you're just kind of playing around with the data. And when that positive result appears, you think, oh, well, you know, I guess I must have just been doing the analysis wrong until now. And if I'd really thought hard about this in advance, of course I would have quantified my waves in this particular way. And of course I would have chosen these particular artifact rejection criteria. And of course I'd have controlled for that confounding variable, but not controlled for that other one. And then with harking, similar story. You've got a data set with loads of variables that could plausibly be related, and you explore the data by informally running some analyses. And when variable C shows some relation to variable F, you think, yeah, I'm pretty sure that that's what I predicted all along. So I may be horribly naive, but I think that the more researchers know about these ways to cheat, in inverted commas, the less likely they are to practice them. Because I don't think most researchers are sociopaths using QRPs deliberately. I think they're kind of sleepwalking into it. So the more conscious we are of all the different ways that we could force a positive result, the more vigilant we can be to avoid these pitfalls.
Yeah. So in other words, people aren't deliberately falsifying their data. It's more that they're playing with it till it shows something and they're so excited that they run with it, kind of.
I think that's exactly right. I'm sure there are a few absolute sociopaths out there, but I think they're very few and far between. I think the majority of us are just kind of wandering into this without really being aware of what we're doing.
Yeah. I was just going to say something else about not publishing negative findings or null findings. Mm. Something that dawned on me recently is I can remember thinking about designing an experiment, and I happened to say to somebody, oh, you know, this is your field. Have you ever tried this? Because I was thinking of doing it. And their response was, yeah, we tried that, didn't work. And I thought to myself, golly, if they would have published that, it would have saved, you know, I mean, I didn't do the experiment because I had that conversation. But, you know, how much research do people do that somebody else has already done, said it didn't work, never saw the light of day? So none of us knew it didn't happen or didn't work.
This is such a huge problem. So yeah, one of the many devastating consequences of us failing to publish negative results, one of them, as you say, is just massive amounts of wasted research time with people trying something that's already failed. But there's also the fact that, there's been some really smart modeling studies that have shown that publication of negative results is the single most important factor in making sure that false claims don't become canonized as facts. So preventing a false claim from becoming so widely accepted that we stop questioning it anymore, which obviously is a disaster for scientific knowledge. So yeah, it needs to happen. There absolutely needs to be publication of negative results. It's not a failure to do so is not a benign thing.
And I guess that comes down to the institutional issue, because it can be pretty hard to get a paper of not results accepted in a journal.
Absolutely. That's something that I'm going to touch on later when we talk about potential solutions to this problem. And that's right up there.
Yes. Good. Well, let's lead on to that then. So what can we do to limit or eliminate these questionable research practices?
Based on what we've just been talking about, researchers taking personal responsibility for this stuff is really important, and be, having the awareness of QRPs that allows them to do so. But also, large-scale institutional change is needed, as you've alluded to. And this is needed to alter the incentives and pressures on researchers. So when researchers are being hired or promoted, we need academic employers to be looking at the quality and rigor of a person's research, not just publication and citation counts. We need journals to be welcoming of replications and welcoming of negative results, as you say, enthusiastically welcoming, I would say. And this creates, apart from anything else, less pressure on researchers to churn out positive and novel findings. We also need to create structures that help researchers be rigorous about avoiding QRPs. So researchers need to be forcefully encouraged to lock down study designs in absolute detail before gathering any data, so that there just isn't any scope later on to p-hack or hark once the data have been gathered. And this is achieved for the most part using pre-registration, which is where researchers upload very detailed study protocols to somewhere like the Open Science Framework website. And this means that these protocols can then be checked later to see if the researchers did what they said they would do. And journals can also support this by insisting on thorough pre-registration for all confirmatory studies. And they can also encourage novel publishing approaches like two-stage review and registered reports. And what those are essentially is about judging studies based on methods rather than judging studies based on whether they've produced exciting looking positive results.
Yeah, well, certainly can't disagree with that. But I do have a question about that. So, presumably, you know, one can discover things that one hadn't hypothesized up front. How do we allow that to happen if we can only work within a framework of what we propose up front?
You're absolutely right. It's absolutely vital that unhypothesized effects are explored and made public so that other people can look at them in more detail. And the way we handle this is a framework where we distinguish between confirmatory analyses and exploratory analyses. So when the data come in, if you have made clear hypotheses about certain things and laid out in detail exactly how you're going to analyze the data to test these hypotheses, then those are your confirmatory analyses. So these are the research questions that you're investigating to try and find out, is there solid evidence for this effect or not? Any other poking around that you do in your data has to be regarded as exploratory. And when it comes to that, you're not really gaining evidence for an effect when you're doing those exploratory analyses. What you're doing is seeing if there's some hint of an effect that then is about generating new hypotheses for further studies. And the really crucial thing is that when researchers are reporting the results of a study, they need to distinguish absolutely explicitly between which are their confirmatory analyses, which should have been set out in a pre-registered protocol, and which are their exploratory analyses that are more about generating new hypotheses for further research.
That's really good guidelines, yes. Thank you. Okay, so on a sort of small scale, so what would you say that we, say at MANCAD, should all be doing?
I think there's plenty we should be doing, and quite a lot of it is already being done, excitingly. So one thing is that we need to be insisting on high quality pre-registration. And thankfully, that's something that MANCAD, I think, has got under their belt. We need to be offering researchers good, critical statistical advice and training. We need to make sure that every researcher knows in detail about QRPs and how damaging they are and how easy they are to fall into. And on a more human level, I think we also need to be encouraging researchers to just get comfortable with negative results and get comfortable with messy results so that they're not tempted to fix them, in inverted commas. And in fact, I would contend that actually bosses need to be celebrating when their underlings produce messy results and negative results because they're evidence that they're working honestly. I think we also need to be encouraging replication studies. We need to be strongly encouraging publication of negative results. And we also need to be making sure that we're resourcing adequately powered studies. Because as I said earlier, many QRPs are made easier or made worse by small sample sizes and low power.
Yes. So it seems like there's two approaches. There's the sort of the ground up level, which is us as researchers need to be changing our practices. And then there's the higher level institutional change that needs to come from above, where journals are more accepting of negative results, institutions change their expectations, and that eventually we can improve things.
Yeah, I'd absolutely agree. I mean, I think each one of those aspects is necessary, but not sufficient to solve the replication crisis.
Yeah, as they happen together. So far we've talked then about, as a researcher, the way to go about it. So how about as a consumer of research, when you're reading journal articles, what should you be looking out for? And how can you decide whether an article is trustworthy, if you like?
I think there are a few things that you can keep an eye out for. So I think you need to keep a wary eye out for small sample sizes, especially if they're coupled with big claims, which they shouldn't be. I think it's worth keeping an eye out for p-values just below 0.05 or just below 0.01, which, as I said, are a bit of a telltale sign. I think you need to keep an eye out for lack of correction for multiple comparisons, absolutely. Or inadequate correction for multiple comparisons, where, you know, something seems to have been done in that regard, but perhaps not everything that needed to be done. I think we need to be taking novel claims with a pinch of salt if they haven't been replicated. But by far the biggest culprit and the biggest thing we should be looking out for is what I would call hidden multiplicity. So hints that researchers could have chopped up and analysed their data set in a lot of different ways and then picked the analyses that gave them positive results. And I would say the red flags for this are studies with a large number of potential independent variables and dependent variables. If they offer scope for a number of potential comparisons that haven't then been reported by the researchers. And I think it's also worth looking out for hypotheses that look a little bit odd. So if you've got some hypotheses that are not the obvious way to use the variables or address the research questions, I think you've got to have an eye out there for potential harking. But of course, a lot of this potential post-hoc manipulation is hard to spot. The only real way to be sure that it hasn't happened is good, thorough pre-registration. So if there's one thing listeners take away from this conversation, I would like it to be that science will probably stay broken until researchers get comfortable with pre-reg and get comfortable with doing it well.
Good message. I know that I am guilty of many of these things that you've talked about, and it does really make me go away and think, golly, I need to be a lot more clean, kind of. I think that's what we all need to be, clean and direct and straightforward. And as you say, accepting of null results.
Yeah, clean and direct and straightforward, but actually just honest as well about how easy this stuff is to do and how probably there's very few of us who have absolutely clean hands. I'm sure that I haven't at all times. So I think the more we get honest about our failings, the easier it is for us collectively to address them.
Yep, I agree. Well, Hannah, thank you. Very thought-provoking and I think really valuable. I hope lots of people listen to this and reconsider some of their practices. But as you say, it's not directly trying to falsify results. It's just being sort of swept away in the approach that people take these days. So thank you.
Well, thanks, Gabby, for having me. And my email address will be in the transcript if anyone wants to contact me about these or related issues.
Thank you. Thank you, Hannah. Thought-provoking, fascinating discussion. As I said, we'll have a transcript available. If you have any follow-up questions or you want to give me some feedback or share ideas about future topics for podcasts, please send me an email. My email address will be in the transcript and on the ManCAD webpage. Hope you enjoyed the discussion and that you'll come back for our next podcast, and I'll get the word out when the next one is available.